Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Roger Greenwald.
Thank you. My father wasn't in heaven. There was no heaven. My father lived in the past, though his body didn't live. It was in the ground. The past was with us, but gone. For me, at 4, it had been gone forever. So my questions were like my questions about the moon and the snow. But my mother was only 18 months a widow. What could I know of 18 months except that another planet hung behind them? Was there life on that planet, or only snapshots and legends, courtship and wedding photos, birth, the white cottage in Jersey, the German shepherd named Bambi? Like retired actors, the people I knew who were in those pictures were connected only by light rays to their otherworldly younger doubles captured on film. There was no point asking them about the other planet. They surely wouldn't know a thing. My mother was the only one who'd been rocketed out of that realm and into the Bronx. And I was the only one whose special powers could project me back there. So I didn't ask his parents about my father. I didn't ask his brother about my father. I didn't ask his many aunts and uncles about my father. I asked my father, who couldn't answer. I asked my mother, who tried to answer. I asked myself and became the answer.
What is the question, or is the question kind of an unspoken question?
I think I wrote the poem about the realization of how odd it was not to have asked relatives about my father. They knew him, after all. He died when I was young, and I think I imagined that he was in some realm that was so different that these living people couldn't know anything about him. Either that, or I just had some childish investment in maintaining whatever image of him I had and didn't want reality to intrude upon it. It happens that I lived for many years on Clinton Street, just south of here. So I'm going to read this poem of Clinton and Bloor Streets from that time when there had been a large influx of refugees from Chile. The sun and the moon. The South American people are all happier when the warm weather comes, standing in doorways on the main street, down from apartments above stores. The woman saying, "It's the truth," and the big man with her laughing big laughs that merge into words with a string of chicha-in. Or walking up my street like this woman with her husband, and I catch that it's coming or they're coming. While back of the next car, a station wagon, a boy is helping his father unload, and they're smiling. The boy with the flat oval face, copper skin, and those clear eyes, black hair combed with water with the wide teeth of the comb. Their language is silky and glints like the light from the mouths of the ones with gold in their teeth, and the light from the curls of the red-headed woman pacing her son to school in the morning, late in the strong sun, with steps too long for him, but reassuring, with her whistling S's that shoot up to my window. I know in the hot nights the music will start from them, high up in balconies and open bedrooms with dull wallpaper in dull light. The reeds and gentle drums and bells and maracas, shouts between panpipes, soft flutes, hoarse flutes, whispering flutes, and bird-like ones. This you hear from the street on humid nights when Spanish suspends in the air so the moon is brushed to a gold that recalls the source of the light, where the light comes from. Where the light comes from is sung when the windows are closed and glints from the tortuous grooves of a phonograph record made in some country or other, wherever they could. It's true, la verdad, that the Spanish-American people are happier when the warm weather comes, happier than, and this makes a dance like the sun in their eyes, like a certain food from home that they haven't had for too long. Twilight, orange, guitars. The fading globe. Beneath the skin, the oranges, fragrant lines. In the park, walking round pools and spheres, the fountain's gleaming molecular body, rounding off, in fact, the Mercator horizon of the plateau. There is precession, there is commanding form, discordantly tensile, memory of the sun, everything but meeting. Steel strings snap, wish the buildings down, long to travel. Oh, the smell, the oil, some missing smile emerging as I part the lobes, like a sandstorm from the west. Poem from a line by Jarrell that I thought was by Williams. I've never read or imagined anything like this going down the stairs after the slides like live preparations, relieved, tiny, and phosphorescent to walk you to the subway at 12:40, not disastrously late, and the wanting, seeing rocks and waters not enough, to show you more. Reminds me, as you open the doors, first the inner and holding it the outer, of it's funny how we want beauty, isn't it? Still beauty, which goes unsaid. Being other than yours that I tell you. For this is not that thirst, nor any incorporative desire, nor the edgy opening we sight through at the making something elegant and spare, but maybe simpler, like here is what I found. Let me show you this rock I brought home, or this creature's shell, or in the book, the part of a man that is homeless here on earth. And how I snorted at my own mistake that lit in me, skipping off Jarrell's tribute like a plover. Hope I'd find a Williams poem that began, I've never read or imagined anything like this in my life, and the rest he would have given us as gladly as we make a wish after a sudden unison that stops our talking.
Tell me about Charles Douglas. It sounds like he's remained somewhat obscure, but he's someone that you still champion.
Charles Douglas went to the University of Toronto, published some poems fairly early on in Tamarack Review, and I later published poems of his in several issues of the literary annual that I edited, RIT magazine, W-R-I-T. And he has worked full-time all his life and raised some children, and I don't want to say exactly where he worked because I'm, you know, not at liberty to give you the details of his life, but what spare time he has had, he has used on reading and writing and has therefore accumulated many manuscripts and made some sporadic attempts to get them published as books, which attempts have not succeeded, and so he has this marvelous trove of work in his drawers, and I hope that they will see the light of day sometime soon.
Why do you like him?
Why do I like him? His work is most unusual, I think, certainly in the context of Canadian poetry, for its combination of deep intellect with verbal playfulness. He often shifts registers as the poem goes along, and he's written some very humorous poems and some very deep poems, so I think he has a great deal to offer. Thanks. Those of us who read tonight were offered the opportunity to read one poem by a Canadian poet in honor of National Poetry Week, month, sorry. And you heard Mick read Keith Millard's poem. And I thought I would take the opportunity to read a poem by a very fine poet who's been doing excellent work for over 40 years and has no published books. So you will have to hunt out the work of Charles Douglas in old magazines like Tamarack Review or Writ Magazine, which I edited. This is poem 19 from a series called 19 Poems, therefore the last poem, Charles Douglas. For a long time now, you have suspected acquiescence, the fall of snow along the rails, the gray alterability of the horizon. Read as unsigned invitations, it is pointless to refuse. So are we going? Though it isn't a going anywhere in particular, a changing in stature before the romantic backdrop, but rather, as the sun breaks in the shelter, a sense of waiting forever at our destination. As the sun breaks on the boots of many arrivals. And if the train doors opened, we would accept the taunt and the journey as if it were landscape shifting, the peel of roads and mountains over the more tidal core, which is us. And if we go, the world remains as seedless, a motiveless history, full and floodlit, exactly as advertised. But even underground, our journey will observe laws of topography until an eruption becomes like a wart, a small disturbance of physiognomy, and each of our acts the weight of a stone on the hillside under the freedom system. As you may imagine from Valentino's introduction mentioning my translations, I've spent a good deal of time in Scandinavia, and some of these poems come from those times. Their lives. When you arrive, you'd better follow local customs. In the cafes, search for faces you know. Well, since you have the language, you can talk to a waiter. They're not here to make your acquaintance. They have their lives. In winter, work or study. In summer, cottages or expeditions in pairs to see the exotic and oppressed in small doses. At a certain hour, a woman in her bedroom will think for 90 seconds of meeting someone like you. That is, approximately like you. Norway. Norway is my grandmother's house, though she never lived here. These wooden floors, plaster moldings, are hers, though she did not have them. She sat by these ripply windows when I left and when I came back, waving in both directions. Her kitchen was not like Norway, but she is here in the sound of a wood board hung by its hole on a wood peg. Norwegian is her language, though she did not speak it. I hear her in the rise and the tone fall. Norway is her granite and her hands, warm under the blanket to see if my feet are too cold for sleep. Norway is the comforter she never owned in a white cotton sleeve as smooth as her arm. Norway is the nameless country she left, the landscape of names I return to. I translate from Norwegian, Danish, and Swedish, but Norwegian is the language I know best and that I speak myself. It's not part of my family background. I think I've always been attracted to northern places and northern landscapes, rocks and water and evergreens. And when I went to Europe for the first time, that was one of the places I went, in part because people told me how nice it was and beautiful and how friendly people were in many of the port cities on the West Coast.
That's true, because they're used to having greeted visitors through the Hanseatic League and all the shipping trade that came through there. And I felt an affinity for the landscape and the language. And as a poet, I naturally try to translate things that I can read that other people can't by way of giving them the gift of that poetry if I think highly of it. I only translate what I think highly of.
You generally seem to be going after sort of very sort of small moments, little statements by people, or little, you know, or you're kind of blowing up a small instant into something monumental. I don't know, like the universe in the grain of sand or something like that. Is that correct? Is that what you're trying to do, or what you find yourself doing?
I hesitate to say that anybody's take on my poems is incorrect, because, of course, as you know, we write intuitively and we do all kinds of things that we're not even aware of ourselves. So I'm happy to have anyone get what they get out of my poems. I would not have put it that way, but it's an interesting comment. I would almost have to go back and look at what I read tonight and see if they could be taken that way. I think that my desire in poems, my aim for the poems that I hope to write, and maybe the few I've written that I think are best, is to intertwine a train of thought, a train of ideas, with an expression of feeling about the ideas or about something that's happening, a narrative element in the poem, and to have those two things go braided through the poem, and to get the emotional impact partly through the voice, through the rhythm and the sound.
Welcome back, come again. The whole poem is in quotation marks. Before you arrived, the weather was so fine. Too bad you couldn't come earlier. Where have you been? Oh, I know, in that ugly place where you slave away. I meant, why there and not here? And now that you're leaving, it's clearing again. You just about have time for one long walk this sunny evening in the forests surrounding the city. Did you notice that sound as though a woman were coming through the trees and her silver earrings rang faintly against themselves? It was a small bird that's impossible to see and has therefore never been named. And the mirrored pines are almost perfectly still now. There's a slight ripple, but we may as well keep going. You could wait a long time before the water yielded glass, and anyway, by then it might be dark. Listen to the parchment of those aspen leaves tapping like meek castanets. Now you know why the water kept moving. Maybe you should settle somewhere like this, not in the forest, of course, but within reach. It's a shame you couldn't stay longer. Tomorrow, the great Russian pianist is giving a concert. Next time, you'll have to come sooner. Next time, you ought to bring less work, see more friends, admire their children, go to the movies. You can come to dinner. We'll invite people you know. Thanks for the walk. Have a good trip.